Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the notorious Auschwitz concentration camp was liberated 70 years ago today. We'll speak with someone who was held captive there and didn't tell his story for 65 years.
But first, our top story for the day today. A winter blizzard has unleashed its fury on the entire Northeast. About 35,000 people have lost power in Connecticut and Massachusetts. Off Cape Cod in Massachusetts, the entire island of Nantucket is now without power. In Framingham, just west of Boston, officials report some 30 inches of snow. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker said this morning that the outages could have been worse.
The power outage numbers at this point are significantly below where we anticipated they would be. That's a really good thing. That's due in large part to the fact that the temperature was a bit colder than I think most people anticipated it would be, and as a result, the snow is a lot lighter and fluffier.
Snow, wind, coastal flooding are all expected to pound New England throughout the day today. But in New York and New Jersey, travel bans have been lifted now. In New York City, the subways and buses are all rolling again. For more in the storm, we're joined by Sam Champion, anchor and managing editor for the Weather Channel. He's with us from New York City. Welcome back, Sam.
Hey, Lisa, how are you this morning?
I'm okay. We're surrounded in white, and I guess you are too. But could you give us an overview of where the storm hit hardest and where it's now headed?
Yeah, there's no doubt about where the storm hit hardest. It was a very tight storm, about 1,500 miles across. And so what we're looking at now is from central Long Island all the way east, Suffolk County getting hardest hit. Coastal areas, some coastal communities in New Jersey hit hard with coastal effects of that rough surf and tough winds. So anywhere right along the shore, and then it widens out a little bit as you start to go north. So once you get into Connecticut, Rhode Island, now you're starting to see inland impacts, definitely in toward Massachusetts. So you just said the 30-inch snowfall total that was there, over 18 inches in parts of Boston so far, over 20 inches in parts of Rhode Island. And as you start to work out to Maine, you're getting the same type of snow reports. I'm just pulling up some of the snow reports right now in Hartford County in Connecticut. We've got 21.5 inches in Marlborough, all the way down to Windsor Locks, which is a little bit further south, at, you know, just almost 5 inches of snow. So a very tight gradient in snow from east to west. It drops off dramatically.
And it's now headed where? Where's the bulk of the storm at this point?
We'll spend a good part of the day with this thing still cruising by the coastline. It'll take some time to get Boston out. It'll be by the afternoon when this thing will tighten up and slowly start to pull away into the Canadian Maritimes, you know, up into the open ocean. So it'll take a good part of the day for that to happen, and certainly into the evening for things down east Maine and the coast of Maine to start to get a little bit better. But it'll rapidly clear once it does start to pull away, and you'll start to break into sunshine. We're getting sunshine in New York City breaking through the clouds right now, and that's exactly what's going to happen continually north.
Okay, and in terms of the characteristics of this particular storm, you've been watching it really carefully over the past 24 hours, actually a lot longer than that. How would you characterize the storm in terms of what's transpired?
I would actually say in many, many ways, it's a classic nor'easter, but definitely one of the most powerful storms that we've seen. It'll have some history-making elements to it. You've highlighted a lot of the damage that we've seen in many, many communities, and it'll be a real coastal problem and a real snow problem for areas in the Northeast. Then you'll look at it in places like New York City, won't remember it as much. It'll be the city that it'll be the storm that shut down the city, but shut it down due to concerns for travel, you know, in areas like New York, in Newark, in Hartford. But as you start to work north and east, it'll be remembered as one of the top listing snowstorms of our time. So a powerful nor'easter, and in typical fashion, what happens with them is when they're offshore, they really have a lot of ocean moisture to deal with, and it's how far west they can throw the snow. And so you'll always see a very sharp cutoff. And so you play the game with how strong this storm is and then how far it can throw snow. And so forecasters are always kind of watching that, monitoring it to what the extent will be. Just to give you a quick show, Lisa, of it. If you get into the center part of Suffolk County in Long Island, you know, you've got 22, 24 inches of snow. Just go 45, 50 miles and you're in 8 inches of snow. Mm. So that's a really, really incredibly steep, you know, changeover.
Sam Champion, thank you for watching it for us, monitoring it for us, and talking to us about it in the aftermath. Sam Champion, anchor and managing editor for the Weather Channel from New York City. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Well, as we continue to follow the storm, we want to note an important anniversary. 70 years ago today, Soviet troops liberated the Nazi concentration camp Auschwitz, a camp where more than a million prisoners died, most of them Jewish. There are some who survived, including Leslie Schwartz. He and his family were sent to Auschwitz from their home in Hungary in 1944 when he was just 14 years old. He was the only member of his family to survive. But for 65 years, he didn't tell his story until a few years ago when he started touring schools in Germany to tell students what he had been through. I spoke with Leslie Schwartz last year and asked him to take us back to the moment when he and his family were brought to Auschwitz.
We arrived midnight in Birkenau, and the SS came up, everybody out, leave everything behind. And I was confused. My mom was holding her six-month-old little baby, Eva, and my sister was next to her. And I did not know what to do. Shall I go with my stepfather or shall I go with my mom? Hmm. But when I looked up and I saw this fire burning in front of me, coming out of a chimney, it was a very frightening thing for me to see. So the line was moving slowly, and where the ladies were, there was a lot of screaming, where babies were immediately taken away from the mother's arm, which of course my poor mother, six-month-old little girl, was taken. And that kind of frightened me. So I decided to stay with the grown-ups. And I was in Auschwitz approximately 10 days, and life was unbearable. The daily seeing all these people, they were carried, dead ones, sick ones. And we had access to go from one barrack to the next. And my best friend's brother, who was 5 years older, I went to him and I said to him, "Sandor, do you mind if I go with you?" He says, "Come." And that saved my life.
But you did not see your family again.
I did not stay with the children. And all those children, of course, wind up in the crematorium. My fortune was that by volunteering, you know, they were selecting people to leave Auschwitz. And that was my good fortune. And I wind up in Dachau.
But that was the last time that you saw your family.
Right.
So tell us about the day that you thought that you had been freed, the following year in 1945.
On April 25th, we were put on these wagons, cattle car, and this journey lasted from April 25th to April 30th. No water, no toilet, no anything. Starvation, of course, was to the point where I don't know if I would have endured much more of it. Hmm. We came to a small town called Poying. And I noticed some of our guards, they were removing their uniform and putting on civilian clothes. And one waved to us, "Ihrseid frei," which means you are free. So I noticed that this Poing is a farmland, and I said to my two friends, "Let's go and see. Maybe we can get something to eat in this farm." So I walked in, and the lady, she was a very religious woman, a Catholic lady, and she hugged me like a mother, gave me a glass of milk and a delicious piece of bread with fresh butter that she has just made the old-fashioned way. Suddenly I hear, "Hands up." I said, "My gosh, I came this far to be killed." So I jumped over the fence. I don't know how I did it. And I kept running and running, and but he got me. A bullet went in my neck and exited on my cheek. I fell, and he said, "I see you're still alive. Either you get up or I have to give you another bullet." I said, "No, I get up."
Wow.
So I got up. I was thrown back into the wagons with dead people, wounded people, and I was in terrible, terrible agony. And finally, we were liberated. Next morning at 10 a.m., a town called Tutzing, which is near Munich.
We're speaking with Auschwitz survivor Leslie Schwartz. Today is the 70th anniversary of the liberation of that Nazi concentration camp. And on this 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, we're revisiting our conversation with Leslie Schwartz. He and his family were sent there in 1944 from their home in Hungary. Leslie was the only one in the family who survived, though as we heard before the break, he was shot in the neck before he was liberated. After the war, Leslie Schwartz moved to the United States, and he kept silent about what happened to him during the Holocaust for 65 years. Now he's spending a lot of time in Germany telling young people there about what happened to him and his family. I asked him why he kept his story quiet for so long.
When I arrived in Los Angeles, I had two uncles of mine living in Los Angeles. And they said to me, "You are now living in the United States. Forget everything that happened to you."
They told you to forget everything.
Yeah, I was 16 years old, and, I was a kid. And the lady who used to give me a piece of bread when I was near the concentration camp Dachau, a camp called Alloch, she would throw me a piece of bread from time to time. And after the war, I went to visit the family, and I kept in touch with them until she died. Frau Riesch, and I kept in touch with her, and we corresponded. She called me my son, and I called her my mother. But the lady who gave me the glass of milk in 1945, I went back to that village, and I was not able to find her. And for 65 years, that bugged the hell out of me. It was an obsession with me almost daily. Why couldn't I find this woman?
So after all that time, you spent many, many years not talking about your experience, and now you have toured dozens of high schools to talk about it. Why did you decide to do that?
the gentleman that I was reunited, his name is Max Mannheimer. He is 94 years old. And Max Mannheimer has been doing this since 1946. I have no idea how many schools he has visited, but he is constantly on the go. And I was 14 when I was in Dachau, and Max was 25. And I visited Max, and I decided then and there that I am going to do what Max is doing.
Why? What was it about that made you decide that?
Well, number one, the new generation of Germany, they have been treating me royally. And I call it the healing process. Suddenly to be accepted and loved and cared for, where prior to that I was nothing but a piece of dirt. That's all we used to hear in concentration camp. And suddenly they have built me up to the point where I feel really great. It's amazing what people can do to people.
Do the children that you're talking to now, do they understand what you're telling them about what happened to you? Do you think that they recognize the realities of the Holocaust?
Very, very much so. And I find this among the girls. Many of them cry. And when I'm finished, they all congregate and embrace me, and it is a feeling that I wish more of my Holocaust survivors would experience.
To tell their stories.
Yeah.
Well, what do you get out of it?
Emotionally, feeling, it's a satisfaction of bringing me to a point where I am now kind of pleased the way my life is coming to an end. I also had the privilege of meeting Chancellor Angela Merkel, who wrote the most beautiful letter to me. On the official stationery from the parliament, and she included an English translation. So I don't have to tell you. Suddenly, this 14-year-old kid is being showered with all these honors that I've been going through.
When you go to a Holocaust memorial, for example, the one that's in Berlin, does it feel like it strikes the right tone to you? Does something like that, that the rest of us who didn't experience what you experienced, that we see, does that tell people the story, do you think?
I think so. I feel at ease. It took 65 years.
Well, Leslie, for those listeners that we have who have not heard your story and are hearing it for the first time, what would you like to leave them with?
I want to leave a permanent legacy about my life. That such a thing should never occur, and we must be diligent about something that no one ever should experience what I have experienced as a 14-year-old kid.
Yeah, it's hard to even hear, especially the story of you standing there with your mother and your stepfather in the camp I'm surprised you're even able to hold on to that memory, because I feel that if I had a memory like that, I would want to block it out of my mind.
Yeah, unfortunately, I cannot.
Well, Leslie Schwartz, we thank you for sharing your experiences with us.
My pleasure.
Yesterday, officials announced a security breach of White House grounds for the second time in less than 6 months. This time, the culprit was a 2-foot drone, something you can buy in a store. Officials say the drone was not dangerous. A government employee claims to have been operating the drone. Officials have not yet filed charges against him. The incident raises questions, though, about the safety risk posed by consumer drones. Here was President Obama speaking with CNN's Fareed Zakaria.
You know, in some ways, Fareed, this is similar to what's happened in cyberspace. These technologies that we're developing had the capacity to empower individuals in ways that we couldn't even imagine 10, 15 years ago.
That's President Obama. Katie Barrett is the deputy reviewer of editor of the technology news site Recode. She joins us now from Washington. Katie, the White House reportedly has a radar system to defend against planes and missiles. So how could a 2-pound, 2-foot-long drone get through?
Hi, Lisa. Yeah, this is interesting because this was such a small device that it really snuck under the radar. They said that it could be confused with a bird. And so I suppose that there is a danger to the smaller devices as well as the larger devices. We don't necessarily think of something so small being dangerous, but certainly our minds go to the worst possible scenario where there might be, for example, some kind of explosive strapped on that device. And let's not forget that the fact that this was 3 a.m., and it wasn't exactly midday that this was being flown, so it was a little bit strange, if you ask me.
So what about the person who was flying it at 3 a.m. and it just happened to go across over the White House fence, maybe or maybe not have gone into a tree? We're not quite sure.
Right.
What do we know about the employee, this government employee, and how it all happened?
Right. I have just heard that it is a government employee. It is not an employee of the White House. He came forward and, talked to the Secret Service on his own and said he was the one who had been flying this drone just for his, own enjoyment, and that there was nothing untoward here. They said he's been fully cooperative. But, I think it's a little bit strange. These drones have batteries that only last for about 20 minutes. So it's not as if he was off in his neighborhood in, upper Northwest, and he just went for a long walk for an hour and he happened on the White House. This was obviously intentional that he was there. I'm sure it wasn't intentional that the drone fell into the White House. But, this sends up alarms. We obviously, it's kind of like the digital fence jumper, in my opinion. We saw that and we're so surprised by it. But, here's something else that we're so surprised by. It seems like we're catching up to these things after they happen rather than actively or being proactive about them.
So what are counterterrorism officials, and we know they are talking about this, what are they talking about in terms of preventing any kind of future incident?
I don't know, to be honest with you. They've said that, they have some kind of plan in place, but I don't know. I haven't reported on that specifically.
Okay. Thanks for talking to us about this incident. Katie Barrett, Deputy Reviews Editor for the technology news site Recode. Thanks a lot, Katie.
Thank you, Lisa.
Snow plows and snow blowers, a common sound across New England today as a howling blizzard with wind gusts over 70 miles per hour hits the region. Some communities have already seen more than 2 feet of snow from this winter blast, and it could end up as one of the top snowstorms of all time in New England. The National Weather Service says wind gusts approached 80 miles per hour on Nantucket, thousands without power there and on Cape Cod. Here now is Alex Ashlock is dusting the snow off his boots, and he's in the studio with us now. And Alex, maybe this storm didn't live up to the forecasts in some places like New York City and Philadelphia, but it is certainly hitting hard here.
It's blasting Massachusetts, Jeremy. The snow is blowing because of those high winds you mentioned. That also means in addition to the snow, it's very cold. Wind chills out there today below zero. Visibility also very difficult, basically whiteout conditions in some places in Massachusetts. It does seem, though, Jeremy, that people are heeding the advice from state officials to stay off the highways. Boston basically looks like a ghost town. I know you've been out today. You've seen that.
Yeah.
I was out on the main street today, Commonwealth Avenue here. I didn't see much activity besides those snow plows and the workers clearing the sidewalks. Boston University is closed. Public schools in Boston closed today and also tomorrow.
Yeah, basically, the shorter list would be what is open today. I decided to walk in to the office this morning, and it took me a lot longer than it ordinarily would. I actually ended up wearing ski goggles to get in because the wind was blowing so hard and blowing the snow all over the place.
And you didn't have much company.
I did not have much company. How is the storm affecting travel?
Well, travel is bad today across New England and mainly in Massachusetts. More than 7,000 flights have been canceled up and down the East Coast. Some of the travel bans in other states, New York and Philadelphia, have been lifted, and Massachusetts still has some travel bans in place. Amtrak says there's limited service between New York and Albany, New York, as the storm conditions ease. We talked a little bit about how there was nobody out today. I did catch up with a woman who managed to make it to work just like we did today. She works at one of the few businesses that is open. Her name is Tywee Small. She works at a CVS pharmacy.
I think we should have closed, though, but hey, I guess we like with the doctors if they need to send over a prescription, so I'm working today.
So she's working. If people want to get around, and this is a big question, if you can't drive on the roads and you can't take public transit, what are you supposed to do?
Well, you do what you did this morning, and you do what Tywee was doing. She was walking on the street going to work today. The subway system here in Boston, the T, is shut down. People are being asked to stay off the roads, but there are the snow plows out there. I caught up with a man named Danny Devaney. He works for the town of Brookline, Massachusetts. And Jeremy, he'd been on the job since 10 o'clock last night.
Well, I'm just trying to stay ahead of it. I just grabbed a cup of coffee. I'm going to have a little quick snack and back at it. You got to keep going. Got to stay ahead of it.
So that's a snowplow driver that has had to spend a lot of time working. What about power outages, Alex? Thousands of people without power.
Thousands of people without power, mainly on Cape Cod and Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. The colder than expected weather produced this light and fluffy snow, which really isn't collecting on power lines. So that's a good thing. But there is some flooding along the coast. It's been a major concern of state officials. They have been assisting in a handful of voluntary evacuations in places like Marshfield, Hull, and Scituate. Those are on the coast. Coastal roads as well closed because of the flooding, which isn't usual for a storm of this size.
Well, and actually yesterday we were speaking with somebody from the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency, and I said to him, what are you most concerned about here, the snowfall, the wind, or the tides? He said, I think you've got it in reverse order. The tides are a real problem.
Right. And he put, as I said, they are evacuating some people from those areas. But again, these are places that are used to these sort of conditions, and they're prepared for situations like this. And we had a lot of warning about this storm as well because of the forecast. Jeremy, there are some huge snowfall totals here from the storm so far. You mentioned that at the beginning. Framingham, which is in the central part of the state, actually just west of Boston, as of midday, reported 30 inches of snow, yeah. 26.2 inches in Shrewsbury. So lots of snow out there in this storm.
Here now is Alex Ashlock, who has been out on the streets of Boston today, which is one of the worst places in terms of how this storm has impacted the region. Alex, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we've heard all about what it is like to be out in that snowstorm, but what if you've never seen snow before, let alone a huge blizzard or nor'easter? That is exactly what happened with three Saudi students who arrived just last week to study English at Boston University. And Here and Now producer Karen Miller-Medson met with them outside their dorm, where one had no hat on, one had no gloves, and the third was wearing slippers.
I'm Ziad Ghatani from Saudi Arabia.
I'm Abdulrahman Abdul from Saudi Arabia.
I'm Abdulaziz Dimashqi. We are all from Saudi Arabia, and we are 18.
And I hear that you just arrived here.
Like 1 week. I never seen something like sand, but with white color. I used to see a lot of dust in my country, but in the city Boston, I never seen this before.
Yeah, it's very freezing here, and the snow in everywhere. You can't see the street. That's good experience for us.
It's not like the sand. It's soft. And the best natural thing I have seen it, it's the river. It's have a white reflection.
So have any of you tried to do anything in the snow? Have you made snowballs? Have you walked in it? Have you sat in it?
We used to throw some balls at each other, like a wall, a big wall. So I think we have an appointment today, like a big wall with another student.
Yeah, we meet the snowman and throw the ice to my friend and like that. That's very funny.
Did you have any fear before the storm?
No, I was excited for this windstorm because I never seen windstorm before. So I prepared for this storm with my device to take a picture for this storm.
Have you been taking pictures to send back home?
Yeah, we take a lot of pictures and sent to my father and my parents. You told me that's good, but take care for yourself.
What about your parents? Were they worried?
No, but they said the university give you the vacation to stay at home, you know, to go and playing around. Stay at home, it's dangerous weather.
And yet you're all going to go out and play anyways.
Yeah.
We have to.
Over the weekend, Pope Francis became the first pontiff to hold a private meeting with a person who is transgender. This pope has been praised for promoting gender inclusiveness in many realms of the church and other forms of inclusiveness as well. The pope has yet to make or even discuss substantial change, though, in the role of women in the church. 6 years ago, under the previous pope, the Vatican launched a controversial investigation into the work and lives of American nuns. This was met with a lot of outrage among nuns and many members of the church, too. This past December, the results of the investigation were released. Under this pope, the results were much more positive than expected, and the nuns' response was more positive. Sister Joan Chittister is an author, public speaker, and a Benedictine nun. She lives in Erie, Pennsylvania. We asked her what place she sees for women during this time of transition under this pope.
I would not deny that in every dimension of the church, there is a great respect for the sisters. But since Vatican II, sisters have grown up too, just like women everywhere. And they're basically highly educated and very committed people. So when they began to function with confidence as full adults, that threatened an old church. The image of women religious by church men themselves was the eternal silent servant. So now you have a body of intelligent, educated adult women, and you're facing a new climate in the church with a pope who is apparently not afraid of difficult topics.
Could you describe for us the institutions that you're talking about that women religious, that nuns have established and have embarked on since Vatican II, and especially in the present day? Because what you're saying is that some in the church see what nuns are doing, what you're doing, as subversive.
Well, if what we're doing now is subversive, then what we did 500 years ago was even more subversive. When Mother Macaulay went out into the streets of Ireland and picked up little girls, brought them into a house, and began to teach little girls to read and to write, there was nothing more subversive in society. So what we're doing now is certainly a natural derivative of that. For instance, I myself began a prison fund. Because we now know who is making up the population of prisons. They're the poorest of the poor. We have begun halfway houses for women in domestic battery, for instance.
There's something else going on here, though, that I think you've been getting pushback on. And it's not just working with the poor, which is very much in line with the current pope. It's not just working on eliminating inequity. It's also having a louder voice than women religious have had in the past.
Yes.
Do you believe that is still considered a threat in some parts of the church?
Oh, I think there's no doubt. I mean, and they have a word for it that's embarrassing. They call it radical feminism, which means they don't even know what radical feminism is. And what they mean is a thinking, articulate woman who has an agenda and intends to pursue it for the sake of women everywhere, as well as the families and the children we serve.
As you well know, and has talked about quite a bit, women cannot be priests still in the Catholic Church, and that has been basically reiterated by Pope Francis. At his ordination, he declared the Vatican's opposition to the ordination of women as an issue that was closed. Why do you think, with all the progress that he is being credited for, that's one of the issues where the door is closed?
Oh, well, look, Lisa, this anti-female attitude, they don't want to call it that. They'll never call it that. We respect you. We love you. Look at how we put you on a pedestal, meaning as long as you're on a pedestal, you yourself can't move anyplace. This is very, very ingrained in churches in general and in the Catholic Church, certainly. Now, this Pope has said, quote, feminism is about allowing every member of the human race to become a fully functioning human adult. He has made those statements, and he has talked about the fact that until we really look at the feminist issue, he says, quote, we have to work harder to develop a profound theology of the woman. Only by making this step will it be possible to better reflect on their function within the church. Now, I think we could just start with a profound theology of the human, and we wouldn't necessarily be starting on the same foot we always have, as in women are different than men, women are not as fully human as men, women do have different, totally different gifts than men. There's no sense in that. This Pope, however, has opened the door to the question. If it's still a question for men, we'll help them answer it. But it has to be addressed. You have to remember, too, that as much as we don't want to admit it, churches also taught racism, anti-Semitism, and slavery, just as well as they teach sexism yet today. If this Pope, with what I see as a powerful and graced openness to the questions in our society, really pursues this question, then we will all have a new consciousness of what it means to be human, to be female as well as male, and to be a church that's really a church.
I wonder what hope you have of that.
As a matter of fact, Lisa, I take it for granted. I'm not even sure it's hope anymore, because we're on the wrong side of history. Every single thing that we have dealt with this way has fallen, and we know it. And this will fall too, because it is so wrong. It's theologically untenable. It's psychologically ridiculous, and it's scientifically bizarre and bankrupt.
Although theologically, Pope John Paul VI said in his position, as you well know, in much more detail, that Jesus chose for his apostles only from among men. In the practice of the church has imitated Christ in choosing only men, that the exclusion of women from the priesthood is in accordance with God's plan for his church.
Yeah, I know all that as well as you do, and it's real and it's here with us today. Nevertheless, the fact of the matter is, this is not a truth of the church, because the church has never, as a church, discussed it. I have said repeatedly for 15 years, I don't come with answers, but I know what the questions are, and they are refusing to deal with this question because they know its answer as well as you do. Every poll shows us that the greatest degree of alienation from churches is among college-age, single women with leadership abilities. They see no place for themselves in this church. They don't buy that old, unsustainable theology, history, politics, or science. That will have to be dealt with. It's an undigested mass in the middle of the church, and it simply cannot forever be ignored.
Why is it so important for you in this church that nuns, as active as you are, and you've been telling us about the deep changes, profound changes that are being made in attitudes and in activities by American nuns. Why is it so important that women become priests in the Roman Catholic Church?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, they could declare it open tomorrow, and very few women may show up. It's not important that women become priests. It is important that women's integrity as fully functioning spiritual and rational human beings have the possibility of being anything in the church or in society.
Sister Joan Chittister, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa.
Joan Chittister's newest book is coming out next month. It's called Between the Dark and the Daylight. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.